We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Back to court in the Brian Koberger case, a hearing just taking place just the other day. Not with, fireworks, but a pretrial rulings that quietly decide what the jury will actually get to hear when things finally go to trial. We're talking about Amazon purchase histories, 911 call audio, surviving roommate testimony, and whether bushy eyebrows are legally significant enough to tip a murder case. And just to make things even trickier, we've got autism, alibis, and the death penalty all tangled up into this legal chess match. So with all of these evidentiary decisions still hanging in the balance, we brought in someone who knows exactly how these courtroom rules shape a case, former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis. Now, Eric, when a judge is making all of these pretrial calls about the jury, what they can and what they can't hear, especially in a death penalty case like this, how much does that shape the outcome before trial even begins?
It really installs parameters for the case. You know, there's all this information we've heard about the case, but only some of that is going to be legally admissible. It puts up some guardrails, kind of. So the judge can ensure that the case doesn't go completely off the rails with, you know, conspiracy theories or evidence that is not legally competent and admissible. And so it really sort of shapes what the jury is going to hear and affects the strategy on both sides based on what those pretrial rulings will be.
And there's a lot of thing. I mean, basically, Ann Taylor went through the laundry list of trying to get everything excluded and saw what stuck. I was kind of like, it's funny watching her. She's a great attorney. But I feel like sometimes it's like watching like my daughter, like try and tell me something and then stand back and wait. Like, what are they going to say? Is he going to say, can I go to the sleepover tonight? Can I do this? Can I do that? And then you wait for the response. It's like, okay, well, what about this? What if I do it this way? That's kind of how it feels like it's kind of coming about. But I don't blame her. She's doing her job. 911 call, that was one of the things that the defense, of course, wanted excluded. They tried to keep it, that emotional 911 call from the surviving roommates out due to hearsay. The judge said most of it qualifies under an exception here, under the excited utterance exception. Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So the general rule is that hearsay, out-of-court statements, do not get to be admitted to trial, but there are exceptions. One is excited utterance. So what that means is that if a person was under such a distressing or excitable set of circumstances that they uttered something, the rationale is that it's more likely than not that that would be a true statement, just because it's spontaneous. It's just coming out of them based on sort of what they're being affected by. They don't have time to strategize and contemplate it and manipulate it or fabricate things. And so that is the exception that 911 calls are often let in under. And I think it was certainly the right call to let this one in. I think it's relevant and the jury needs to hear it.
Yeah, I felt like it was a stretch to say that the 911 call on this very case, we don't want that in there. That's not appropriate. I know they were also trying to argue terms as well, like murder. even though it's like, it's what he's charged with. But somehow they thought, well, the jury could get some impression that he's a murderer and he's not yet convicted of it. Like, well, he's charged with murder. Again, was that a stretch where they're trying to argue like words of murder should not be in a trial like this or shouldn't, can only be used in certain contexts?
You know, words have a serious effect, including on jurors. They can be evocative. They can conjure up ideas and notions and other events that aren't related to the trial. So oftentimes the defense will seek to limit verbiage that can be used. Another one that's common is when they try to eliminate the use of the word victim, because at this point it's an alleged victim and victim just has sort of an emotionally charged concept that's attached to it. That being said, murder is the charge, man. And so of course the jury's going to hear about that, and judges aren't usually inclined to, you know, really police the language used by both sides.
Murder was the case that they gave him. So it's kind of, it's not shoplifting.
That's Snoop Dogg. Yeah,
exactly. Murder was the case. Another one, psychopath, sociopath. The judge agreed on this one. I'm interested as to how and why they were so concerned about these terms being introduced when the prosecution, he was like, we're not really planning on doing that to begin with, because it's not really contextually part of the case. But I mean, I get it. You don't want those terms out there. But I mean, are they? It seems like there's something else behind the curtain here that we don't know about yet, that they're very concerned could come to light. So the judge is banning the terms to prevent the jury. But what if there is something out here? I mean, is there a way? Is there some sort of diagnosis? Is there some sort of evaluation that puts them into those categories? And if there is, like scientifically, medically, I would think that that could be used if that's there.
That would be a very intuitive take on it, certainly. And, you know, I'm not privy to all of the evidence in this case, but more than likely there is mental health information contained within that, you know, large swath of evidence. I think defense is worried that terms like psychopath and sociopath, you know, we start thinking about, you know, raped serial killers and things like that. And if that is attached to the defendant, that of course could have a prejudicial effect. The jury could say, hey, you know, I don't know if the evidence is here, but if this guy's a psychopath, I don't want him out in my streets. I'm going to convict him in part on that basis. That would be improper, and that could result in a reversal of the conviction. And so I think it is prudent to try to exclude such inflammatory terms like that.
Could those terms be used in the sentencing phase of the trial? If he's found guilty, obviously you wouldn't get to a sentencing phase without it, but if he's found guilty, I mean, you can't just like throw it around for fun, but I mean, could it be used there if there is, I mean, he's found guilty and you killed all those people? I mean, that's kind of psychotic. Is he just banning it from the trial portion of the case?
What it sounds like is those terms are just being banned from the guilt phase of the death penalty trial. If Koberger's convicted, there'll be a penalty phase at which the jury will decide whether Koberger should be put to death or not. And at that phase, things open up substantially. There's a lot more information that is admissible at the penalty phase that wouldn't be admissible at the guilt phase, because the question is broader. The question is, really, does this guy deserve death? And so, you know, could one side propose that a mental health expert has diagnosed somebody as a psychopath or sociopath if that has happened? You know, I think they could certainly offer that. The judge would have to be careful, but that type of information, especially as it relates to whether a person might commit a crime later or is a violent risk to society, even in prison, that information is relevant at a penalty phase.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where sometimes less is more. If they've already sunk their ship over here, you don't need to keep, you know, shooting cannonballs at it. If it's already down. Another term that they had some issue with here, the defense had issue with, touch DNA. I mean, it's been a key part of all of this. It's a key piece of evidence. And it's not a defamatory term. It's just, it's a definition term of what it is, of the type of DNA that they found on the knife sheath. The judge ultimately ruling the jurors can handle understanding that term. What is the argument on that one of from the defense as to why that term would be, I guess, defamatory or something that would sway a jury one way or another?
You know, one is that it's hurtful to my case. That's ground the defense is probably thinking about. You know, I think what they're trying to say is they've been attacking the DNA and the way the DNA analysis was conducted from very early on in this case. And this is just another argument trying to chip away at the state's DNA evidence. But touch DNA is a very common concept. It comes up in nearly any case in which DNA is implicated. I've never seen a judge exclude it. I think if it comes into evidence, the jury could infer that, oh, that means he must have touched these things like the knife sheath, and it came back to him and his DNA, and that's really problematic for them.
Another problematic thing is the alibi, the stargazing, which it was cloudy that night. But you know, one can say I usually go out and stargaze. You probably, you know, a pattern of behavior would be nice to see on that through something to show that this is, you know, a regular thing for him. I don't know that they have that. But they are saying that if you're going to use the I was out looking at stars defense, then you get to testify. That's the point of entry. Must be this tall to ride the ride if you're going to go down that road. Or if it's we have some sort of witness corroborating this, which I would think if they had that, they would already have been talking about that by now. Is this going to get Koberger on the stand? Do you think it's something that's important enough that they need to have an alibi in this case? Or is it on their part, less is more, because it could lead to too many other offshoots that are not going to be beneficial to Koberger?
Koberger's attorney is in a dilemma on this alibi thing, because in order for information to go to the jury, you have to have someone testify who has personal knowledge of that information. The only person who would have personal knowledge of whether Koberger was out driving around looking at the stars is Koberger. There's no insinuation that there was somebody who was riding with him that no one has heard about. You know, even if Koberger talked about later doing stargazing or whatever, that would be a prior consistent statement. But I think in order to get the alibi itself in front of the jury, Koberger's got to take that stand. And that opens up a number of risks and contingencies that are really troubling and exciting if you're a legal expert and things like that.
I mean, that's the only alibi they've ever presented. Is that simply because they can't produce any other sort of alibi? There's nobody else to talk to. We know that. But why not? Like, yes, you got him. The cell data shows he's driving around. That's his alibi. He was moving around. The only data you don't have is between those hours. But he was driving around. It clearly shows. It turns back on, and he was driving around later. I mean, could they go down some sort of road there of, clearly, you see he was driving. The phone went off. Has your phone ever died? Your phone ever turned off? But again, they can look at the data on the phone and say, here's your phone. Literally, it was shut off. The battery didn't die. Yeah, there isn't much of an alibi here. How important is that going to be to have an alibi in a case like this? It seems pretty important to say what the hell you were doing and just conveniently you disappear from the map during those hours.
You know, this case is kind of a whodunit. And so what that means is the defense has to try to show, hey, it wasn't my guy. But in order for them to do that, like you said, there could be cell phone analysis saying that he was driving around at some point. But that doesn't get us to the inferential leap of he was, you know, doing this habit that he does, driving around stargazing. In order for that specific information to come into the jury, someone's got to testify about that. Now, would the judge allow some latitude for defense in a closing argument to sort of drum up some conclusion based on the cell phone coordinates and stuff like that? Possibly, but usually for an alibi, you've got to meet an evidentiary standard before it will even go to the jury. And I'm not sure simply cell phone locational data gets you to, oh, he was driving around looking at stars because this is what he does. And he's just an innocent dude.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.